My name is Dick Miller. I teach in the Department of Philosophy, and I'm director of the Program on Ethics and Public Life. This is the second of six public lectures this spring on the politics and ethics of the rise of China. And why China? Well, that's sort of a stupid question now. China is the center of all humanity's attention because of 30 years of stupendous growth involving the liberation of hundreds of millions of people from poverty. Justin Yifu Lin has played a major role in advising, in steering that great transformation of China. And now he is deriving lessons from that great transformation to liberate hundreds of millions more from poverty. I think that makes him a perfect speaker in our series on the rise of China. Kent Fox, our provost, will welcome Justin Lin to Cornell. Ishwar Prasad of the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management and the Department of Economics will say some more words of introduction. And then Justin Lin will give his talk on demystifying the Chinese economy. So, Kent.
Thank you, Professor Miller. It's a real honor and privilege to welcome to Cornell Dr. Justin Yifu Lin. Dr. Lin is Senior Vice President and also Chief Economist of the World Bank. In three decades of pioneering work as a leading economist in China and now at the World Bank, he has found ways to combine market incentives and government initiatives, efficiency and equity, pragmatism and bold ambition. Drawing on rich and diverse experience and education, including a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago, he's helped make respect for what markets can do and fear of the consequences of defying their logic a hallmark of China's policies. Yet Dr. Lin has also played a leading role in describing what government can and should do, for example, in bringing more benefits of growth to the Chinese countryside. In this way, as Professor Miller said, he's made a significant contribution to a truly outstanding achievement, 10% growth a year on average for three decades, thereby liberating nearly half a billion people in China from poverty. In over 20 books and a great many articles, as a professor at Beida, Peking University in China, and a founding director of his China Center for Economic Research, Dr. Lin has offered guidance and powerful explanations of China's economic transformation. He's also derived fundamental lessons from China's rise for economic development in the world at large. So it's entirely fitting and exceptionally productive when Justin Yifu Lin became the first chief economist of the World Bank in 2008. Professor Miller has told me that Lin Yifu means a persistent person on a long journey. Well, I'm delighted that Dr. Lin's long and continuing endeavor to better the people of China, to better the lives of the people of China and the world at large has brought him to Cornell to give today's public lecture, Demystifying the Chinese Economy. As Professor Miller said, Professor Ishwar Prasad will now come forward and make a few introductory remarks.
Thank you, Kent. Clearly, Justin is very popular. I don't have to say too much more about what he has accomplished, but I want to give you a sense of the texture, really, of what he has meant to the profession and to the Chinese economy in particular. Now, as you know, ever since the global financial crisis and even before, China has struck out on its own path. Many of us economists, including those of us, and I like to count myself in the company of Justin, who were trained at the University of Chicago, have a particular way of looking at markets and how societies function. China has moved forward in a very different way, a very pragmatic approach, one that has sometimes been characterized as crossing the river by stepping the stones. But moving beyond those sorts of metaphors, the issue is that it's a very pragmatic approach that absorbs a variety of ideas and then molds them in order to deal with the Chinese institutional and other circumstances and constraints. Now, a lot of this has happened without an analytical roadmap, and the economists at least are very uncomfortable when things happen in the real world that don't quite fit in with our models. And our existing models have not been very good at being able to capture the intricacies of developing economies. And this is where Justin's work has been especially influential. He's tried to grapple with some of the really difficult issues in economics these days, thinking about how emerging market economies, developing economies that have a variety of constraints, weak institutions that are just coming up that don't match up with what are typically thought of as advanced economy institutions, financial markets that are relatively underdeveloped, and how these economies should make the transition from where they are to where they perhaps ought to be is a very important and difficult issue to deal with in our standard models. Of course, after the financial crisis, even the endpoints have become a lot blurrier. And this is where Justin's work has been enormously influential in terms of guiding the next generation of thinkers about how we should incorporate these constraints into our models. And Justin is also remarkable in terms of how he's been able to meld academic work with very direct policy work. He's written very good papers that are extraordinarily well cited, a huge number of books. In fact, when I went to have lunch with him at the World Bank a few weeks ago, he had produced this book, and I asked him, so what are you working on next, Justin? And he said, well, I'm working on another book, but by the way, I have a book that is being released by Oxford University Press tonight, and another one being released in 2 weeks. So in the midst of all his other policy work, he's managed to be extraordinarily prolific in terms of guiding academic thinking. And I think he's already created a tremendous impression on the profession, and we're all counting on much more from Justin. So we're delighted to have him here at Cornell. Thank you, Justin, and we now look forward to hearing your lecture.
Provost Fox and Professor Millers and Professor Eswar Passant, it's a true honor for me to, you know, Cornell to give this speech lectures to sell some of my ideas about the Chinese economy. Because China started the economic transition at the end of 1978. And so it's 33 years now. And if we wanted to find a world to describe this process, I think that the only suitable world should be miracles. Because when China started this transition in 1978, the per capita income in China was only $182 per person per year. And it was less than one-third of the average in sub-Saharan African country in that year, less than one-third. But in the past 32 years, from 79 to 2010, the average annual growth rate was 9.9%, which we never observed in a human economic history. And because of that, the gross national product, GDP in China, increased 20.5 times. And by the time of 2010, the per capita income in China reached $4,376 per person. And it was about four times of the average in sub-Saharan African countries. From less than one-third to four times in only 3 decades. And this process is reforming the Chinese economy and opening up Chinese economy. Because when this journey started in 78, China was a very inward-looking cross economy because trade as a percentage of Chinese economy, was only 9.5% of the Chinese economy. China export about 4.7% of its product to the world. China import 4.8% from the world. But in the past 32 years, the growth rate of trade in China reached 16.3% per year. And the trade in China, in terms of volume, increased 144 times. And by 2010, the trade dependent ratio, that is export plus import, as a percentage of GDP, increased from 9.5% to more than 60%. And if you use the trade dependent ratio, export and import, as a percentage of the GDP as a measurement of the openness of an economy, China can be claimed as the most open large economy in the world. So-called large economy is an economy with population of more than 100 million. Because for the U.S., the trade-dependent ratio was less than 25%. It was similar to Germany. It was similar to Japan. But China now is over 60%. So China is the most open large economy in the whole world. And during these 32 years, the Chinese society was transformed because at the end of 1978, more than 80% of the population in China lived on agriculture. They were poor. And during these 32 years, China transformed from a poor agrarian economy to the workshop of the whole world. Exported so many manufacturing products to the high-income country, to the middle-income country, to the low-income country. And China now is the largest exporter in the whole world. Certainly, you all know China also overtook Japan, became the second largest economy in the world by the time of 2010. And during this process, more than 600 million people get out of poverty. I know that many professors, faculty, students here working on the poverty reduction issue. And I like to claim China made the largest contribution to the poverty reduction in the whole world in the past 32 years. Because we know UN has one millennium development goal, and the number one goal is to reduce poverty by half compared to 1990s by the time of 1915. But China alone made the goal achieved several years ago already. And at the same time, if you take out all of China in the calculation, the number of poverty in the world did not decline, continued to increase. So the achievement in the millennium goal number one basically was because of China's contribution. And China not only contributed to the improvement of the living standards, reduction of the poverty. In the past 32 years, China also made a lot of contribution to the world, exemplified first by 1998, when the East Asian economies was hit by a financial crisis. And at the time, China did not depreciate the Chinese currency, helped the other East Asian economy to avoid the competitive devaluation, provide stability. At the same time, during the crisis, China continued to grow at a rate of about 8%, create a market, create a momentum, help other East Asian economies to recover from the crisis. At the beginning, most people thought that East Asian economies would take at least 10 years to recover. But in effect, about 2 years, all the East Asian economy started to grow very dynamically. And China made a very important contribution to that. And the second one is the current global crisis started in 2008. China quickly introduced a large package of fiscal stimulus. And China started to have a recovery in the fourth quarter of 2009. And it maintained a growth rate of 9-10%. Even the rest of the world was in crisis. And this growth momentum helped the global recovery. And then my question is, all this achievement was something which people did not expect it at all. Because in the past 32 years, most time people always thought that China is going to collapse. China has so many problems. For example, in 2001, one of the most popular books that you could buy in any places, in any airport, in any bookstore, called The Coming Collapse of the Chinese Economy. And it seemed to be so convincing because it lists all those evidence, you know, the structural issue, the institution issue, the corruption, and so on. And so he predicted that China would collapse in a few years. But if you look back, from 78 to 2000, before the book published, the average annual growth rate in China was 9.6%. And after his book was published, 2001 to 2010, even with the global crisis, the average annual growth rate in those 10 years was 10.5%, was even higher than all his data based. So it was out of almost everyone's expectation. In effect, it was also out of the Chinese leaders' expectation. Because when the reform started in 78, everyone know it was led by Deng Xiaoping. And in 1980, Deng Xiaoping set a target for China's transition, for China's reform. The target was to quadruple the Chinese economy in 20 years. At that time, I was a graduate student at the Peking University. And I wanted to understand what was the implication of quadruple of the Chinese economy in 20 years. What kind of growth rate would be required to achieve that? At that time, I did not have calculators. I did not have computers. So I used my hand to calculate. And I used, you know, the approximation. So I started with, if China grew at 5% per year, so 1.05 multiplied for 20 times is too low. Then I used, if China grew at 10% per year, 1.1 and multiplied 20 times, it was too high. And so I spent a whole afternoon. Finally, I figured out China needed to grow at 7.2% per year, continuous for 20 years in order to quadruple the Chinese economy. At that time, as a student, I could not believe it. Because in a textbook, I learned a theory called natural rate of growth. And the natural rate of growth taught me any country in the world, except for recovery from the world destruction or natural calamity, it was impossible to grow at 7%, especially for several years. Since you had a theory proved by mathematics and empirical, you know, testing, so I was convinced. And so I went to ask my professors. At that time, China started to have, you know, invite foreign professor to teach in China. And I remember there was a professor called Bernard from New York University. And he taught us you know, modern economics. So I went to ask him. Now the Chinese government target was to grow at 7.2% per year continuously for 20 years. Do you think it's achievable or not? And Professor Bernard told me it was infeasible. So at that time I thought Deng Xiaoping was a very good politician. Because a good politician should set a target so high to mobilize people to work harder for that target, right? And in China, we have a saying to say, set the target high, work hard. Even if you cannot achieve the target, at least you can achieve middle ground, right? If you set the target on the middle ground, then people will not work that hard, and then you will achieve nothing, right? So I thought that Deng Xiaoping was a very good politician. But now I'm convinced Deng Xiaoping was a great statement because China now, as I mentioned, grew at a rate of 9.9%, not for 20 years, but for 32 years. And the difference seemed to be small because 9.9 and 7.2, the difference was only 2.7%, right? But over 32 years, the difference is so huge. Because if China grew at 7.2% per year, after 32 years, the economic size in China will increase 9.2 times. But as I mentioned, China grew at 9.9%, 2.7% higher than the target. After 32 years, the economic size in China increased to 20.5 times, more than double of the original target. Well, then as a professor, I wanted to understand how come such a miracle was possible for China. Certainly, I also wanted to understand how come it was impossible before the reform started in 1979. Because China, the same China, people, the same people. How come there's such a dramatic difference before the transition in 79 and after the transition in 79? Certainly, you will say the answer is very simple. It's a transition. Make all this possible, right? Then my question is that, well, in the 1980s, China was not the only country to have the transition. You have so many other socialist countries. They also engaged in transition in the 1980s and the 1990s. In fact, it was not only the socialist country, almost all the developing countries in the world all had some kind of reform and transition in the 1980s, 1990s. And how come they could not have a similar economic performance? What was the reason? And then my other question is that everything should have two sides, right? Yes, China's performance was so wonderful in the past 32 years. But what are the costs? What are the costs? And then, well, if there are some drawbacks, the question will be, can China continue this kind of growth rate in the coming decades, in the coming year or not? And finally, now I'm the chief economist of the World Bank. I certainly concern the poor people in Africa, the poor people in South Asia, the poor people in Latin America, and so on. So my question is that, can they grow at the same rate as China for 10 years, for 20 years, to get rid of poverty? So those are the six questions I'd like to share with you about my perception, about my analysis. The first one is that why it was possible? Well, my answer is that the high economic growth rate is a modern phenomenon because according to some historian, you know, one just passed away, like Angus Madison, and many others also support his statement. That is before the 17th, 18th century, the average annual growth rate for country like in now the high income part of the world, Western European country, and certainly the rest of the world similar, was about 0.05% per year. And what is implications? It means that it took about 1,400 years to double the per capita income. That means that in any people, in any human being's lifetime, they cannot perceive the changes in their well-being, in the material good that they can command. That was before the 18th century. And after the 18th century, in the 19th century, the rate of growth jumped from 0.05% per year to about 1% per year. And this kind of 20-time jump means what? The time it took to double per capita income reduced from 1,400 years down to about 70 years. So in the 19th century, if you are healthy, you are lucky enough, and you have 70 years of life, then compared to when you were young, the material good that you can use, you can command, will be increased 100%. For the Western European country, North America, those industrialized high-income countries now, entering into the 20th century, the rate of growth doubled again. It changed from 1% per year to about 2% per year. And the time it took to double per capita income reduced from 70 years down to about 35 years. So that means what? Now most people in a high-income country, they are in a life expectancy is more than 70 years, right? So that means that for every person, compared to when he is young, when he retire, when he can start to enjoy his good life, the material goods that he could have will increase about four times, quadruples. And how come there were such a dramatic changes from it took about 1,400 years down to now in the high income part of the world, reduced down to about 35 years? Everyone knows it was because of Industrial Revolution, right? In the mid-18th century, there was an Industrial Revolution. Because of Industrial Revolution, the rate of technological changes accelerated. Labor productivity increased. Create other new industries which will have a higher value added. And so in every profession, your productivity improved, and you can also move from area like agriculture, which value added was small, to area with higher value added. And that was the reason why the income growth can be accelerated in such a dramatic fashion. But if the technological changes, you know, made possible by the Industrial Revolution was the reason for the success in the West, and it contributed to the so-called Great Divergence, then for a low-income country, actually, they can have some kind of we call latecomer advantages or advantages of backwardness, right? Because for the high-income country, since the Industrial Revolution, they were on the global technological frontier. And for every new technology, they need to invent it. And it's very costly, very risky. The chance of success is so small. But as a developing country, if you know how to use the technological gap with the high-income country, and use those kind of gap, because for economists, for economy, the important thing is innovation. Innovation means what? Means that in next period of production, you use something which is better than you are using now. And so you can absorb you can import technology which are mature in a high-income country, which you know, already mature and are not protected by patent. And turn it into your production, you can use it without cost. And they are mature, and you don't have to pay any cost of the invention. So you can accelerate your growth in technology much faster than the high-income country. And after the Second World War, there are 13 economies in the world, according to a Growth Commission report headed by Michael Spence, the Nobel Prize winner. After the Second World War, there were 13 economies in the world tap into that potential and achieve 7% or more growth rate per year, continuously for 25 years or more. And China became one of those 13 economies after 1979. That means after the transition started in 1979, China tapped into that advantage of backwardness and to have a very fast rate of technological innovation, structural transformation. So China could achieve such a high rate of growth. But if the advantage of the backwardness is a secret of the success for China in the past 32 years, then become a puzzle. It becomes a puzzle again. The advantage of backwardness has been there for a century, right? The 19th century, 20th century, most of the time, those advantage of backwardness has been there. And how come China benefit from the advantage of backwardness only up to 1979? It's a puzzle, right? And the answer is because the strategy that China adopted before the 1979, because after the 1950s, you know, before 1950, there was a lot of civil war and so on, so certainly it was impossible to develop China, right? After 1949, the socialist government was established. China, you know, started to have a peaceful time for national reconstruction. At that time, the goal of Chairman Mao, another great man in China, was to overtake United Kingdom in 10 years, to catch up the U.S. in 15 years. That means what? China wanted to develop those advanced industries like UK immediately, so China could overtake UK in 15 years. China can have a similar industry, similar technologies in 15 years. China did achieve some, because starting from 1953, China started to have the first five-year plan to pursue these strategies. By 1960s, China already could test nuclear weapon, just like Iran wanted to do now, right? In 1970s, China could launch satellite. Yes, in terms of industry, China did achieve. But the trouble is that those new industries in a high-income country, in the UK and in the United States, they are all under patent protection. If China wanted to get those kind of technology, China needed to pay high license fee. But in effect, even China wanted to pay license fee, the U.S. and the U.K. would not give those kind of technology to China, right? Because they relate to national security. So that means what? In the 1950s, in order to catch up U.S., U.K., China needed to reinvent the wheel. A lot of cost in R&D in order to invent those kind of technology. And it's very costly. Not only so, more serious. Those industries were so capital intensive. China was an agrarian economy, so capital skills. So China did not have competitive advantage in those kind of industries. Since China did not have competitive advantage in those kind of industries, that means what? Firm enterprises in those kind of sectors were not viable in an open competitive market. And their investment and a continuous operation rely on government protection and subsidies. But how to protect them, how to subsidize them? Rely on all kinds of distortion, financial repression, overvalued exchange rate, intervention in all kinds of market in order to mobilize resources to those very capital intensive sectors. And this kind of system creates all kinds of shortages. With shortages, to guarantee the limited availability of resources will be used for the priority sectors, the government needs to use all kinds of national plan administrative control to allocate resources. As a result, yes, China set up those kind of industry. But there were resource misallocation and all kind of repression or incentive. So it was very inefficient. And that was the reason why that China, even the advantage of backwardness were there, but China could not use those advantages of backwardness to accelerate the technological innovation in China, to accelerate the economic growth. And only after 1979, China started to tap into the potential of advantage of backwardness. Because one of the major changes in 1979 was to start it, develop the labor-intensive sectors, those kind of sectors which very light, did not require a lot of capitals, technology very simple, use a lot of labor. And those kind of sectors were consistent with China's competitive advantages. Since it's consistent with China's competitive advantages, it became very competitive on the market. And so the market share of China's product become larger and larger, and they're more profitable. With the profitabilities, then China can increase the saving and also investment, and capital was accumulated. With the accumulation of the capital, capital become more abundant compared to last year, the year before last. So you need to upgrade your industries. And upgrade industry, again, according to China's competitive advantages. And in this upgrading process, China can benefit from the advantage of backwardness, the latecomer advantages. So that's the reason why that after the reform, the performance in China improved so dramatically. If my analysis is right, another puzzle comes. Because if you look in the 1980s, all the socialist countries started the transition. We know that all the socialist countries after the Second World War followed the Stalinist model. The so-called Stalinist model was the heavy industry-oriented development model. All wanted to build up the modern heavy industries under the government in a planning system. And it was not only the socialist country, it was almost all the developing countries. If you look in the South Asia, India, Egypt, Africa, Latin America country, because at that time, in the 1950s, the perception of modernization is that you need to have modern industry to become a modern country. And the perception is that you need to have a modern industry in order to increase labor productivity to have high income. It's partially right, right? And as they all pursue the so-called heavy industry-oriented or import substitution strategies. And they all have those kind of distortion and government intervention. And certainly they all performed poorly. So by the 1980s, they all started a reform. And the reform was not as good as China because by the time of 2000, one of my former colleagues, Bill Easterly, now he taught at the New York University. He did a comparison. For the developing country, their performance from 1960 to 1980s, and compared the performance from 1980 to 2000, what he found was that the developing country, the average annual growth rate in 60s and 70s was higher than the 80s and 90s. Unlike China, the growth rate was higher, right? Not only the growth rate in the 60s and 70s was higher, the economic volatilities in the 60s and 90s, and 60s and 70s, was lower than the economic volatilities in the 1980s and 1990s. Volatility means a lot of crisis, right? And how come the socialist country and other developing countries, they all have similar problems as China encounters in 1979 when Deng Xiaoping started the reform? How come their performance was so poor? Not only did not improve their performance, in effect, their performance deteriorated. How come it was that? It was because of transition strategies. What's different? Because we know that in the 1980s, the transition in a socialist country, in Latin America, in Africa, was under the guidance, so-called the Washington Consensus. And the Washington Consensus, the idea was to set an institution which you can have a well-functioning market economy. Because before the transition, as I mentioned, all the countries wanted to develop sectors which are against their competitive advantages, so they used all kind of government intervention. Market did not play the function. And they have all kind of distortion. They overvalue their exchange rate. They are suppressing their interest rate, financial repression. They used their own sectors to develop the priority sector and so on. And it's very easy to write an economic model to show. If you have those kind of distortions, you are going to hurt the incentive. If you have those kind of distortion, you are going to misallocate your resources. You are going to be inefficient. And so Washington Consensus advised them to institute the necessary institutions which are required for efficient market in order to improve resource allocation, in order to improve incentive. I think the intention was good. And so the main item was privatization, liberalization, and also stabilization. The state should not subsidize the inefficient sectors. But this Washington Consensus, I think the intention is good, was good, but they forgot one thing. Those kind of institutional distortions, use our jargon, was endogenous, right? They were designed as a way to support those kind of priority sectors in the heavy industries. And in all the socialist countries and many developing countries, you have a lot of firms in those kind of sectors. If you remove all those kind of distortions, what will be the consequence? They are going to collapse immediately, right? Because without protection, without subsidies, they cannot compete in a market. They are going to go bankrupt. And they employ huge number of workers, mostly in the urban areas. And if you allow them to go bankrupt, that means what? That means you're going to have 30% unemployment, 40% unemployment. Not only 30% unemployment and 40% unemployment, they are all concentrated in the cities. What will be the result? Political instability, social instability, right? Without political stability and social stability, can you grow? Surely you cannot. And a politician is not an idiot. When they received advice from Washington about the Washington Consensus reform, immediately they understand if they really enforce those kind of reform, they're going to have a revolt. They're going to lose power. So after the reform was introduced, They introduced other modest guys' subsidies and protections. And those, these guys' subsidy and protection were even more less efficient than the distortion they used to have. This was a debate I participated in early 1990s when Russian, when Eastern European countries started to have a transition. Number one item was privatization, liberalization, and a stabilization. The government should not give subsidies. At that time, I had a debate with colleagues in China, with colleagues in Harvard, and so on. My argument is that if you really wanted to privatize, my prediction was the subsidies will increase instead of reduced, and it will be less efficient. My argument is that, well, those kind of priority sector in the heavy industries, if you allow them to collapse, as I mentioned, it's going to have a revolt, social instability. So the government is going to continue to subsidize them. And if you look into the incentive structure, if the firm in the heavy industry sectors are not viable, they need to have subsidy and protection to survive, right? And that reason why the government want them to continue to survive. One thing was because of employment issue. The other thing is national pride, national security. If Russia today without those kind of heavy industries, they are just a middle income country, right? But they are superpower because they have those kind of industries. So under the kind of situation, for the national security issue and also for the employment issue, the government will continue to subsidize them. Then look into the managers of the state-owned enterprises and the owners of those now called the eight oligopolists in Russia. Those oligopolists, they are not going to subsidize industry for the sake of the nation, right? Certainly, they will use the same argument to say, we are not viable. We need to have protection in order to continue to operate. But compared to the manager of state-owned sectors, and now the owner of the private sectors, who will argue for more protection and subsidies? Certainly the private sectors. Because in the past, when it's still state-owned, the managers were state employees. They will use the viability issue as a way to argue for subsidies and protection. But they cannot pocket those kind of subsidy and protection, right? If they want to pocket those kind of subsidy protection, it was a crime. It was a corruption. But now it becomes private sectors. The more they get from the state, the more they can benefit from that directly, right? So if you look into the incentive structure, you know after the privatization, the subsidy will increase instead of reduced. In the early 1980s, when I argue about this, it was just analysis. But now there are so many evidence, including in 2001, the World Bank passed bridge report called the first 10 years. It has a lot of evidence to support my argument. And many other scholars also show that. And so, use economic jargon what? Before the reform, it was second best. And now, without removing the cause of those kind of distortion, and you wanted to remove those kind of intervention, the economy will drop from the second best to the third best or fourth best. So that's the reason why the average annual growth rate in other transitional economy was lower than their transition, and it was more volatile than their transition. But how come China was so successful? Well, China was a very pragmatic country. China adopted not a shock therapy or Washington consensus. China adopted a dual-track approach to reform. That was recognizing the priority sectors, they are not viable. They need to have protection in order to survive. So the Chinese government continued to give them protection and introduced some kind of marginal reform to improve the incentive. So their productivity improved somewhat. More importantly, China allowed the entry to the sector which used to be replaced, like in labor-intensive sectors. But those are consistent with China's competitive advantages. Allow the entry of the private sectors, joint ventures, foreign direct investment into those kind of sectors. So this kind of dual track, the first track maintains stability of Chinese economy. The second track, because it's consistent with China's competitive advantages, they became very dynamic. And so stability and dynamics were achieved simultaneously. And not only so, the dynamic economic growth in the second track accumulated so many capitals. And so many firms in the first track in the past used to be non-viable. Now, because with the increase in the availability of capital, many of them become viable. They can compete now. Even a few still not viable, the government can allow them to go bankrupt because the second track creates such a large job opportunity. So even they bankrupt, it will not become a social political issue. So that's the reason why the reform in China can achieve stability and dynamic economic growth. Then the question is that, well, what are the costs? There must be some cost there. And certainly there are some costs. The cost is that there are a lot of imbalances in the Chinese economy. And these imbalances, you know, can be captured by the widening of the income disparity. Because before 1979, China was quite an egalitarian society. And its Gini coefficient before 1979, before 1980s, 90s, was only about 0.3, 0.35. And now reached about 0.45, 0.46, close to the situation in Latin America now. And the second one was high saving rate, low consumption. Consumption as a percentage of the Chinese GDP continued to decline. In early 90s, it was about 60% of China's GDP. Now dropped down to about 35%. And the third one was trade imbalance. China enjoyed huge trade surplus, right? And I'd like to say, all these are the legacy of this kind of dual-track reform. Because dual-track reform, I mentioned, the Chinese government continued to subsidize the old priority sectors. And those subsidies, you know, a lot of subsidies has been removed, but there's still three subsidies. One is the financial sectors. The financial sectors in China was over-concentrated in a large bank and equity market. And only large enterprises, or the enterprises owned by the rich people, have an access to those kind of financial services. It was a way to subsidize the old state-owned enterprise, large state-owned. They are capital intensive. They require huge capitals. And to serve them, certainly you need to have a large bank. Small bank cannot serve them. And equity market. But the issue is that the interest rate, the capital cost, was replaced. It's a way for subsidies. But this kind of subsidies means what? Who subsidizes them? People put the money into the system. In general, they are relatively poor. They cannot get financial services. And so you are asking the poor people to subsidize the large corporation, the rich people, the enterprises owned by the rich people. Under this, certainly you are going to see the income distribution become widened. Not only so, this kind of financial system deprived the financial services to agricultural households, to small and medium-sized enterprises in the manufacturing sector, in the service sectors. That means what? That means the development of those kind of labor-intensive agriculture, manufacturing sectors, service sectors. Certainly compared to the past, China in those areas grew very fast. But compared to the possibility, they were replaced also. And those kind of sectors can create a lot of jobs because their growth was replaced. That means the job demand becomes slower, right? As a result, wage rate in China did not increase that fast. And it became another way for the widening of income distribution because poor people, their main income comes from job. But the wage rate had been replaced. And because their wage rate had been replaced, it became a subsidy to the firm, right? So that's the reason why if you look into the, not only income distribution become, you know, widened, we also see that saving as a percentage of GDP increase a lot. And not only so, about half of the saving was corporate saving. And it was because we know that poor people, they have a higher propensity to consume. But their income share become reduced. Rich people's income share and large corporations' income share become larger. And rich people in general, their propensity to save is higher than the poor people. And that's how you can see, you know, saving become larger. And especially large corporations, their propensity to save even higher. So that's the reason why we have the disparity, you know, between consumption and saving. And this also contributes to the trade imbalance. Because you have such a high saving and a lot of investment. But because of low consumption, that means domestic absorption becomes smaller. You produce a lot and domestic absorption is low, then you turn it into trade surplus. So all these are related because of this kind of dual track reform. You know, in the financial sectors, for the purpose of protecting those kind of large corporations in the past, it caused this kind of distortion. And this is not only in the financial sector, but also in the resources sectors and in some service sectors. Like in resources sectors, that loyalty levy in China was almost zero. And so it was a way to subsidize all the resources from in the past. But now the private sector's joint venture can also go into the resources like mining and so on. So they became extremely profitable. It was a transfer of national wealth to those a few companies. Certainly it contributed to their saving, their profitabilities, and also the monopoly in the telecommunication, in the service, in the financial service, and so on. So all those are the reasons why we see this kind of disparity in China continue to become, you know, worse and worse. And the moral is that China needs to complete the transition from the dual track to a well-functioning market economy. Eliminate those kind of distortions. And if China can eliminate those kind of distortions, then the growth in China will create more jobs and increase the income of the poor people. And then the growth can contribute to equity also. My next question, well, China has been growing 9.9% for 32 years. How long China can continue this kind of growth rate? I'm quite optimistic. I think China may be able to maintain around 8% growth rate for another 20 years. How come I'm so optimistic? Well, based on my theory. Because the potential for a developing country to grow rapidly is the advantage of backwardness, right? Is your technological gap, industrial gap with a high-income country. How to measure this gap? I think a good measurement is to see the gap in per capita income measured by purchasing power parity. Because the income measured by purchasing power parity roughly measure a person's labor productivities. And labor productivity is a reflection of the technology used, the capital you used. And so the lower income country means you use less capital. You use in a lower value-added technology, right? Okay. And so this is a measurement. And then we can look into, even after 32 years of so dynamic growth in China, in 2008, that is the newest data I have from Angus Madison, China's per capita income measured by purchasing power parities was 21% of U.S. per capita income. And U.S. represent the industrialized advanced country, right? China was only 21% of the U.S. So the gap is very large. And it was the situation of Japan in 1951. Japan in 1951, its per capita income measured by purchasing power parity was 21% of the U.S. It was Taiwan in 1975. It was Korea in 1977. For Japan, from 1951 to 1971, the average annual growth rate was 9.2%. And for Taiwan, from 75 to 95, it was 8.2%. For Korea, from 77 to 97, its average annual growth rate was 7.6%. And we know that China, the mainland part, after 79, followed the same strategy as other East Asian economies, starting from Japan, then Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. Their pattern of the growth, their development strategies are all the same. Develop their economy according to their competitive advantages. Since they develop their economy according to their competitive advantages, they will export whatever they are good at. They will import whatever they are not good at. They are very competitive. And when they are very competitive, they accumulate the capital. With the capital accumulation, they will upgrade to new industries. In terms of industrial upgrade in general, they follow step by step. And this kind of step by step allow them to tap into the potential advantage of backwardness. I mentioned China after 79. Follow this kind of similar pattern. And with similar technological gap, allow Japan to have 20 years of 9.2, Taiwan, 20 years of 8.3, Korea, 20 years of 7.6. There's no reason to doubt. It's possible for China to continue another 20 years of around 8% growth rate. If China can continue to grow at 8% for another 20 years, that means what? By the time of 2030, what will be the situation? Because after 20 years of high growth in Japan, its size of its per capita income increased from 21% in 51 to 65.6%. In 1971. For Taiwan, from 21% in 75 to 54% in 95. For Korea, from 21% in 77 to 50% in 1997. So if China can maintain 8% growth rate for another 20 years, I think that by the time of 2030, the per capita income in China can reach about 50% of U.S. per capita income measured by purchasing power parity. If measured by market exchange rate, it depends how fast China appreciates the currency. Currently, market exchange rate measurement and purchasing power parity measurement is about one half. That means what? If China maintains current market exchange rate, by the time of 2030, the economic size in China, and the per capita income will be about a quarter of US per capita income. But certainly, China will appreciate, right? And if China appreciates, it depends on how much, how fast the appreciation. And this also means what? If China's per capita income is 50% of US per capita income, how large is the Chinese size? The population size in China is more than 4 times of the US. So if the per capita income in China is 50% of the US per capita income, that means the market size in China will be twice as large. Even measured by a market exchange rate will be at least the same size. So that should be around the picture. Now, my final question. Can we draw some lessons from this analysis? Because we know that Cornell is famous for, you know, the effort to help the developing country to reduce poverty. I know that there's a lot of professors working on this issue. And from my analysis, I'm extremely optimistic. I think all the developing countries in the world should have the opportunity to grow at 8% or more continuously for 20, 30, 40 years. All the developing countries in the world should have the opportunity to get rid of poverty and to move from low income status to middle income status and maybe catch up with the high income country in one generation or two generations. Like in East Asian economies, if they know how to develop their economies according to their competitive advantages, to make them competitive, and by that, they can tap into the potential of advantage of backwardness. Certainly, their growth rate will be much faster than the high-income country. That will provide the opportunity for convergence. So the first principle is develop your economy according to your competitive advantages. And then, by that, you can tap into the potential of advantage of backwardness. But certainly, almost all countries start with all kinds of distortions. And so that's the reason why they are not so efficient now, right? And you need to address the issue of distortion. But you also need to understand the roots of those kind of distortion. And if you understand the roots of those distortion, you will be more sympathetic to the politician there. And some kind of dual track. Allow them continue to protect those kind of sectors which employ so many workers, so many people there. But at the same time, find a way to encourage them to enter into sectors which they have competitive advantages. And by this, they can maintain stability. At the same time, achieve dynamic economic growth. And by that, we also increase their competence and resources to address the distortion in the other sectors. If they can follow that, I think they can also have the opportunity to achieve the stability and dynamic economic growth in the process of their transition. And I think that maybe one day the goal of great harmony, all the countries in the world will achieve the same income status, all the countries in the world will enjoy prosperity. It's not a dream too far away. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lin, for that extraordinarily clear, illuminating, and inspiring lecture. I'm sure you've inspired our students to ask very difficult and challenging questions and challenges professors.
Yeah.
And you've inspired us professors to try to tackle those questions and set very high targets for ourselves and for our students. We have a few minutes for questions, so maybe two or three questions. Please stand up if you're asking a question and keep your question very sharp and precise. And given that we don't have much time left, we'll gather up three or four questions and then let Dr. Lin have the last word. So please.
Okay, good question.
No? Any other questions?
Yep.
I heard that I read out of books before and you made a prediction like 20 years ago about Japan can exceed the economic of the United States in 20 or 30 years and China can exceed the economics of the United States in 40 years. Did you write any books about that?
Okay. Okay.
U.S. is pragmatic.
Huh?
I should ask if U.S. policies are pragmatic.
Oh, yeah. Okay, maybe those are all excellent questions. And I'll reflect your understanding of my lectures and the literature in development. The first question, if you want to develop an industry according to your competitive advantages, for the developing country, the industry they want to enter, in general, are not the industry now currently dominated by high-income country, right? Because when China in 1979 entered into the industries, those are labor-intensive industries. Those are industries dominated by Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia at that time. And when China entered into that industry, how could China compete with them? And how come they are willing to allow China to compete with them? The reason is that you can look into Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and so on. They had been growing dynamically for more than three decades. And they follow their competitive advantages. In the 1950s, 1960s, they all entered into those kind of garment, toy, very labor intensive. But after 20 or 30 years of dynamic growth, their wage rate increased so much. So they are losing competitive advantages in those kind of sectors, right? So they have the incentive to relocate those industries to other economies, which had lower wage rate. China at that time had a low wage rate. And so China wanted to enter that, and they also have an incentive to relocate their production to China. And today, other developing countries can all follow the same strategies. Compared to African country I mentioned, currently the per capita income in China only average is about four times higher than theirs. The wage rate in China is much higher. If China continues to grow at the rate as I described, then the wage rate will, accelerated. Like in last year, the monthly wage rate for unskilled workers, the so-called unskilled worker was lowest high school graduate, went to the factory, received 1 week of training. Those kind of workers. The monthly wage rate was $350. And I'm sure in 10 years' time, their wage rate will reach at least $1,000 per month. So many of those kind of assembly, toy, garment in China, China will lose competitive advantages. But a lot of low-income countries, like in Africa, their wage rate monthly was $50, $100. Even South Africa, considered as a middle-income country in Africa, its minimum wages is $120. Only about one-third of the market exchange rate in China. So under this kind of situation, if they're entering into the industry which China is about to exit, then they can enjoy the advantage of backwardness. So recently I gave a talk at a UN WIDER. It's an institute, World Institute for Development Economic Research. They invited me to give annual lectures. And I point out this opportunity for other developing countries. And at this time, the opportunity is so huge. Because for the East Asia economy, it was successful. As I said, they developed their economy according to their competitive advantages. They enter into the sector, they have competitive advantages. And in general, they attract the high-income countries to relocate their industry to them, right? Japan started to lose that in the 1960s. Korea, Taiwan started to lose that in the 1980s. In the 1960s, the manufacturing sectors in Japan employed 8.2 million workers. In the 1980s, Korea employed 2.4 million, Taiwan 2 million, Hong Kong half a million, Hong Kong a million, and Singapore half a million. Those kind of jobs has been relocated to China. But now China is about to relocate those kind of industry for other countries, right? China currently employed 85 million workers in the manufacturing sectors. Currently, African countries, both north of Sub-Saharan and south of Sub-Saharan, altogether employ 10 million workers in manufacturing sectors. So even 10% relocation of the manufacturing job from China to Africa can double the manufacturing employment. So that's a great opportunity. So it's not the developing country entering into the sector which are dominated by the high-income country. If they try to do that, then it's all strategies. Not a strategy try to develop sectors which you don't have competitive advantages. They should develop the sector which they have competitive advantages and other countries losing competitive advantages. The second one regarding in the 1980s, there was a lot of talk about Japan the first. Japan was about to overtake the US. Yes, in the 1980s, there was a very famous book called Japan the First, produced by one of very famous professors in Harvard. But after the 1990s, Japan, become stagnant, lagging behind. I think there's two reasons. One reason was because of the last decade due to the burst of bubble in the equity market and also in the real estate market. But Japan's manufacturing sector continued to be very competitive. And so, but from 1980s to 2008, U.S. did not have those kind of burst bubble. So U.S. continued to grow, and Japan, because of the lost decades, they did not grow. That's one reason. Second, I think that my perception is that by the time of 1985, 80s, Japan's per capita income in the tradable sectors and productivity already reached the same level as the U.S. But when they reach the same level as the U.S., Japan certainly cannot rely on the advantage of backwardness anymore. Japan needed to, you know, do R&D in order to get a new technology to go into the new industries. In that area, compared to the U.S., Japan has some disadvantages for several reasons. The economic size in Japan was about half of the U.S. population. And if you have the same income level, we know high-income countries all invested about 2.5% to 3% of their GDP for R&D. And that means what? Japan's R&D investment in terms of magnitude will be only half of the U.S. And so the chance of success will be only half of the U.S. That's one disadvantage. The other disadvantage was because that in the advanced sectors, market standard was very important. And the power to set up market standards is related to market size. Suppose the U.S. and Japan was competing on the same technology, and they all have a patent, they are all successful. They use different standards. U.S. has competitive advantages because U.S. has a much larger market size. So in the first batch of production, the U.S. can have a larger production. So unit cost of production in the U.S. will become lower. And that will, even the same product with same quality, same features, will make the U.S. more competitive than Japan. And the third thing, the labor market in the U.S. is an open system. The labor market in Japan is a closed system. So U.S., you have a lot of genius from other countries to come. Japan, in general, is a closed system, so you do not have so many foreigners come to Japan to study and to stay. But we know that in the frontier innovation, it's not only education, it's innate ability that count. And the U.S. have double the population size, that means you have a double the number of genius. On top of that, you attract all the genius in the world come to the U.S. And so, you know, I do not think that according to this kind of analysis, I think that even without the financial bubbles burst in Japan, I do not think Japan could really overtake U.S. My third question is that, do you need to have an autonomous state to implement the reform, the dual-track reform as I just described? Or do you need, you are very polite, you say autonomous state, you did not say that totalitarian state. I mean, I think that you want to use that term, but you are so polite. Thank you very much. I say no. Because the dual track of reform was not invented in China. Dual track of reform, approach to reform, was invented in Mauritius. Mauritius, before 1970s, like Latin America, like any other country, adopt some kind of import substitution strategies with all kind of distortions. And it was very poor. But from 1970s, they started to develop export processing zone to attract the textile and garment industries from Hong Kong, from Taiwan to relocate to Mauritius. In the export processing zone, they liberalized everything. without any kind of government intervention or distortion. But domestic economy, they continue to have the order protection. And with that, the export process system became so successful. Income increase and wage increase, and then they gradually, like China, reform the old sectors. So the dual track reform was not invented in China. It started in Mauritius in the 1970s. And Mauritius is a democratic country, right? So this approach is applicable to any country. Both, you know, more authoritarian society or democratic society. Imbalance. Well, if China continues this kind of imbalance, income disparity will become larger and larger. It can trigger some kind of social political issue. So it's very important for China to, you know, complete the transition from the planned economy to the well-functioning market economy by eliminating those kind of distortions I just described. And luckily, in the 12th five-year plan, all my recommendation, all those things I discussed has been set as a target, policy target of the 12th five-year plan in China. And whether the U.S. should be pragmatic or not, I think every country needs to be pragmatic. Because the world is changing all the time. And in effect, I have another book. I have a new book published about the methodology. In the methodology, I strongly advise any scholar and any politician, when they face the real world problem, they should forget all the theory they learned. They should forget all the experiences they have. Every time when you observe the world, you should have the eyes like a newborn baby. Every time start from scratch, from new, do not count on any theory your professor teach you. Do not count on any experiences you accumulate in the past. Every time need to be new. And then you will ask me, then why I come to Cornell to study? If any theory I cannot count on, how come I come here to study? You come here to study to adopt a ways of thinking. The theory always try to explain what happened in the past, right? But what will happen in the future can be different, right? But you come to study a theory, not to study the conclusion. You come to study how come those smart professors in the past observe the phenomena in that way. Figure out who is the decision maker, what kind of constraint they face, how come they can summarize in that way. Just like if you want to be a master of art, you need to have a stage of copying the old masters, right? And when you copy the old master's masterpiece, it's not to enable you to be able to paint a picture like that. It helps you understand the basic principle of how to construct, how to show the colors, how to show the shade. But you need to have your own way. Similarly, you come to study, it's not to study theory. You come to study a way of thinking and approach to understand the world. If you do that, you will not be very ideological. You will be very pragmatic because every time your solution will be based on the facts, the truth. So you know, the Chinese philosophy is seeking facts, seeking truth from the facts, instead of seeking truth from the books. Thank you.